2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 263, the Freddie Curtis Papers, LDS Church Surveillance of Fundamentalist Mormons, 1937-1954. Participants, Mary Ann Watson and D. Michael Quinn.
Good afternoon. This is Session 263, the Fred Curtis Papers, LDS Church Surveillance of Fundamentalist Mormons, 1937-54. My name is Bob Frame. I'm from Lincoln, Nebraska. That's one of those Gentile college towns out there in quote, the mission field, I believe they call it here in Utah. Actually, I'd like to dispel unfounded rumors here on the Wasatch Front that the good Lord watches collegiate football on Saturdays either in Ute Stadium or Cougar Stadium. The fact is, he watches them in Memorial Stadium, just down the street from me, where the Huskers have only lost one game in the last 14 years. That was a mistake. I understand the Almighty took a rest break that afternoon, but he really does like to watch football there. I knew nothing about the Fred Curtis Papers until I read the preliminary program myself, so I'm anxious to hear Mary Ann T. Watson's sharing with us this afternoon. Mary Ann is a co-author of Voices in Harmony, the Contemporary Women Celebrating Plural Marriages, as some of you undoubtedly know and are probably here because of. Mary Ann's a professional genealogist, a graduate of LDS Business College, belongs to the Mormon History Association, the Utah Historical Society, and certainly not the least of her accomplishments is she is the mother of nine, eight sons and a daughter, plus a grandson. Mary Ann's traveled extensively in Mexico, speaks Spanish, and we look forward to hear from her about the Fred Curtis Papers. Following her paper, we'll hear from respondent Mike Quinn, who undoubtedly needs no introduction to most of you. His extensive bio and credentials would take me half an hour to list. There's three or four of his books right outside the door, and I'm sure a number of you have had the privilege of meeting and hearing from Mike Quinn. And so, without further ado, I'd like to hear from Mary Ann Watson. My fault, I guess. Can you hold that a minute?
Good afternoon. That reminds me of my radio at home. Get too close to it and it buzzes. I'm really pleased to have Mike Quinn here today responding to this. I think he's probably the most well-qualified person to speak. It has to be on in order for it to go into the recording system, but I don't know. Oh, there we go. Okay. I think that he's undoubtedly probably the most well-qualified person to speak, address my paper. The papers down at BYU, the J. Reuben Clark papers, he has, as you well know, has written books and I understand is writing more. And some of the documents with which he's worked with are probably carbon copies of the ones that I have seen. I'll just go right ahead. Housed in the Utah State Archives is a portfolio of papers labeled simply Freddie Curtis, and this is a photocopy of the outside of the portfolio. They are part of the collection of the polygamy investigation files formerly in use by the Attorney General's Office from the 1930s to the 1960s. Okay. This portfolio warrants inspection for two reasons. First, a bishop of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Fred E. Curtis, created these records. Secondly, the presence of these LDS Church records in the Utah Attorney General's office files encouraged more than passing curiosity. What is in these files? Why were they created? Why were they archived in the Attorney General's files, and how did they get there? And finally, what is their significance? Perhaps the context in which the Freddie Curtis files were created should be examined first. The Freddie Curtis papers should probably be viewed within the framework of Mormonism in transition, a term coined by historian Thomas G. Alexander, referring to the first 50 years after the church officially banned plural marriage. During this period, 1890 to 1930, Mormons largely transformed from a distinctive body of religious people striving to maintain a unique identity in the face of tremendous national opposition into a class just like, quote, just like everyone else, unquote. More specifically, the LDS Church evolved, quote, from a society that idealized polygamy to one that, with equal commitment, exalts the traditional monogamous home, unquote. Still, for many Mormons, the transition was a time of extraordinary ambiguity, especially in light of many faithful church members and hierarchy who continued to quietly marry in polygamy for at least 14 years following the church's 1890 manifesto. A small but persistent minority, though deeply committed to the church, believed God had provided a way for continued plural marriage and refused to adjust their beliefs in order to accept the call to mainstream adaptation. Since the church viewed any reemergence of polygamy as an obstacle in its transition toward acceptance by the nation, excommunication of members involved in new plural marriages became routine by the mid-19-teens. Church President Heber J. Grant, whose administration began in 1918, was vehemently opposed to continued plural marriage. Under his leadership, polygamy became a paradox. Those who had lived it in the 1800s could be considered righteous and virtuous, whereas any who presumed to enter new plural marriages in the 20th century were licentious, adulterous, and apostate. It was the latter phase of the church's efforts to redefine celestial marriage and the role of polygamy that the Freddie Curtis papers came into existence. The Freddie Curtis papers are surveillance evidence comprising several hundred documents. The file contains numerous small slips of paper. Maybe I can get somebody to do my overheads for me. You can just go through those quite slowly. So, numerous small slips of paper with handwritten notes, full-size pages of typewritten lists, a small collection of newspaper clippings, bundles of household bills and receipts, and copies of correspondence dating from 1938 to 1954. The files give evidence that Freddie Curtis was appointed, apparently beginning sometime in 1937 or 1938, to observe suspected persons and their households in his vicinity who expressed a continued belief in or who had been heard to preach and or practice plural marriage. Curtis was probably selected on the basis that the Hawthorne Ward boundaries included suspects' homes where gatherings took place. Bishop Curtis was instructed to provide his evidence to the church's first presidency and to the church's presiding bishopric, who then coordinated with him in contacting bishoprics of other wards concerning church members under suspicion. Curtis also worked with the Salt Lake City Police Department, whose cooperation had been obtained. As mentioned before, his records eventually became part of the Utah Attorney General's polygamy investigation files. These files are compelling for several reasons. The extreme detail contained in the papers reveals thousands of hours of church-authorized surveillance that continued at least until 1944, with some indications that ongoing surveillance for some years afterward. The files provide insight into the practices, policies, and institutional attitudes of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints toward 20th century fundamentalist Mormons whom they consider dissidents and apostates. Further, they corroborate fundamentalist Mormon history with events and dates coinciding perfectly with accounts as reported in primary and secondary fundamentalist sources selected for this review. The Freddie Curtis papers signal that in the 1930s, the Church of Jesus Christ had begun a pragmatic and systematic approach to discover members who might advocate or practice plural marriage and purge them from the church through excommunication. These files also evidence church and government collaboration for the purpose of legal prosecution. Three other selected sources were primarily used for this paper. The first was a chapter from J. Reuben Clark, The Church Years by D. Michael Quinn, which draws heavily from Clark's papers and correspondence. I'm going to skip over some of this information about these other things. The second source, I need to say this, though. Clark's first assignment in his church calling as a member of the First Presidency was to draft a statement condemning renegade polygamy. The result was the church's official statement of 1933, which was dubbed the Final Manifesto. 14 printed pages in length, it was the longest denunciation the church has ever officially published against polygamy. President Grant then gave Clark a mandate to suppress the practice of polygamy, and President Clark went at it with a vengeance. The second source consulted for this review was the diary of Joseph Lyman Jessup, and the third source was the fundamentalist Mormon periodical publication Truth, which began circulation in 1935 under the direction of Joseph W. Musser. I'm skipping some of the biographical information on both Jessup and Musser for the sake of time. The Freddie Curtis papers, together with these sources, reveal an intriguing story. Insight is given into two divergent paths: the fundamentalist Mormon effort during the middle of the last century to preserve what they consider to be original Mormonism, and the LDS Church plan of accommodation towards mainstream American culture. Freddie Curtis, sometimes identified, or quite often actually, as Fred E. H. Curtis, had no polygamous ancestry. He was born Frederick Evelyn Hopewell Curtis, November 15, 1900, in Merker, Tooele County, Utah, the oldest of first-generation English immigrant Mormons. In 1933, Curtis was called to serve as a bishop in the Hawthorne Ward of the Granite Stake in Salt Lake City. 4 years later, early in 1937, Bishop Curtis was given a special assignment from the church presidency. Though written instructions have not been found telling Curtis specifically how to proceed, it is apparent that his primary duty was to observe the comings and goings of suspected persons at certain homes where it was believed polygamy-related gatherings were being held. Others who assisted Curtis in his special mission were a brother Ferguson and a Hawthorne Ward high priest named George Lund. Lund was the credit manager for Standard Furniture Company and apparently drove one of its delivery trucks at times to conduct surveillance. The Freddie Curtis papers files Freddie Curtis papers burgeon with handwritten notes written on standard furniture receipt forms or office memos with details about suspected fundamentalists. You might want to put that standard furniture one back up. Mostly they were wedding or birth announcements, probably copied from local newspapers. Curtis also sought the particular expertise of a female private defective, the wife of a former Hawthorne Ward Bishop G.C. Jensen. Sister Jensen was asked to see if she could get into a fundamentalist meeting, posed as an interest religious investigator. The plan failed when her neighbor, who was a regular attendee, recognized her. Sister Mabel Jones, a secretary from the presiding bishop's office, was assigned to help coordinate and facilitate communication between Bishop Curtis and other bishoprics. Later, another secretary was added so the work would not fall behind. The church authorized network engaged to what it amounted to full-fledged investigation of suspects. The process involved taking down license plate numbers of all vehicles parked at or near suspected residences. The arrival and departure times of the vehicles were noted. Bishop Curtis and his assistants wrote letters to vehicle departments in several states to identify car owners. As individuals became identified and then recognized, their names were listed in observation notes. Eventually, minutely detailed lists, as you can see some of these are, arranged by license plate numbers, noted each date each vehicle was observed. You'll see on that one dates out to the side. I've joked before that fundamentalists could reconstruct attendance meetings, who was there, by these papers. Pardon? This is the license plate numbers on the left, typewritten. When they knew a name, they'd type it in next to it. And then you'll see the small dates written in hand. Those are the dates they attended what they consider fundamentalist meetings. I did find a description of the fundamentalist meetings, and they were Book of Mormon study classes, sometimes Doctrine and Covenants, there were just various kinds of gatherings. Bishop Curtis and his sister, local church authorities outside the Hawthorne Ward area were contacted, informed, and questioned regarding suspects. Neighbors of suspects and their fellow ward members were interviewed. Visitors who paid calls at targeted residences often became suspects as well. Newspaper obituaries, birth and wedding announcements concerning any members of the suspect families were clipped and added to the files. Garbage cans at some residences were invaded to obtain copies of bills and receipts to use as evidence. Suspects were traced if they relocated. The earliest letter among the Freddie Curtis papers is dated October 1, 1938. It was typewritten on Hawthorne Ward stationery addressed to the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, attention, President J. Reuben Clark, Jr. The letter began referencing the case of Heber K. Cleveland and his wife, who are holding meetings at their home having to do with plural marriage. It included a list of 30 names and addresses derived from license plate numbers of cars parked near the residence that had been observed during the previous 3 weeks whenever a meeting took place at the Cleveland home. Of course, the bishop cautioned, we do not know whether the owners of these cars have all attended this meeting. Excuse me for not putting all the quote-unquotes in. The letter ended with Curtis's promise to continue to investigate the case and provide, as per request, another list of car owners at the end of 2 weeks. J. Reuben Clark wrote back, stating simply that, quote, we shall be very glad to have the information, unquote. Just 1 month later, Tuesday, November 1st, a document titled Report of the Salt Lake Police Department was typed on Hawthorne Ward letterhead. This police report was the earliest hard evidence in the Freddie Curtis papers demonstrating cooperation between church and government in an organized effort against polygamy. Later, I have to say, in this particular context, later evidence shows that at least two police investigators were assigned to work in conjunction with the church surveillance. The two officers, according to Bishop Curtis, quote, gathered a large amount of information, unquote. Meanwhile, J. Reuben Clark used his influence in other government arenas, even encouraging the Salt Lake City Public Library to exclude fundamentalist polygamy literature from library holdings and asking the Salt Lake City Postmaster to prohibit the mailing of fundamentalist publications. Heber K. Cleveland was among the first to be disfellowshipped from the church as a result of Curtis's activity. Truth Magazine reported portions of the church trial in which George Lund testified, I was appointed by the bishop to investigate these meetings at Brother Cleveland's home about 6 months, unquote. When Lund was asked by Bishop Curtis if he knew if they taught plural marriage at the meeting, Lund answered, no, I don't, only through rumor. The defendant, Heber K. Cleveland, was allowed to question Mr. Lund. Question, Brother Lund, how do you know who took charge? I saw him through the window. How could you see him? The blinds were down. Sometimes the window was up and I could see and hear. And were you on the sidewalk? Which Truth notes was some 25 feet from the house. Yes, but I could both see and hear. Did you hear plural marriage discussed? No. How did you know there was a woman's class? I could see them in the kitchen. How could you? There is not a window facing the street and the front door was closed. I was not on your property. I walked on the driveway of the house north of you. Did you hear plural marriage being taught there? No. What did you hear? I don't remember now. Brother Lund, have you ever known of me telling a lie? No. Have you ever known me to steal, commit murder, commit adultery, bear false witness, drunken with liquor, take in the name of Lord in vain, disturb the peace, refuse to pay my just debts, or conduct myself other than a gentleman and a brother? To each of which questions the answer was no. Can you truthfully say anything against my character, either through personal knowledge or hearsay? No. The other official shadower, identified by Truth as a Brother Fredrickson, also gave corroborating evidence against Cleveland. He stated as his opinion, however, quote, that the character of Brother Cleveland was beyond reproach, unquote. At the end of the trial, Bishop Curtis and his counselors met privately a few minutes and then returned with their decision that Cleveland was to be disfellowshipped. Truth declared the whole affair as, quote, high-handed and irregular procedure, wholly bereft of the Spirit of the Lord and of the rules and the regulations of the church. Elder Cleveland's trial was only the beginning. Curtis soon produced a second list of 83 names and addresses. Within 6 months, excommunications were occurring frequently, systematically. The church's first presidency required an oath of loyalty for those investigated who wished to have their names cleared. Although President Clark did not originate the idea, Quinn suggests, quote, Rubin's experience in overseeing the Justice Department's activity against suspected subversaries during World War I predisposed him to favor a church-wide requirement for suspected fundamentalists. The oath, called the affidavit, required individuals to affix their signature to a document that stated in part, I solemnly declare and affirm that I, without any reservation whatsoever, support the presidency and apostles of the church, that I repudiate any intimation of any one of the presidency and apostles of the church as living a double life, and that I denounce the practice and advocacy of plural marriage, and that I and myself am not living in such alleged marriage relationship. Truth repeatedly decried these loyalty oaths and especially objected to their selective enforcement as part of the church's implied policy of forced unanimity in sustaining church leaders. Much to President Clark's dismay, those being watched were immediately aware of the surveillance. A March 21, 1939, diary entry of Joseph L. Jessup states, attended our priesthood class, our numbers increasing. Spies are at every meeting night watching us. Somebody is evidently worried over our movement, unquote. In another entry, he described the typical situation in more detail. Quote, each Tuesday night I attend our priesthood class at Cleveland. Spies sent by bishops are constantly on the watch but refuse to come in and brazenly conspire against those who attend by taking auto license numbers and noting every person who attends, then reporting to their higher-up authorities who call to trial, mock trial, all they can get to, and are excommunicating every person thus called for their belief in defense of plural marriage. A few weeks later, he recorded a very similar entry. I won't repeat that one. As the frequency of excommunications escalated, Joseph L. Jessup expressed his exasperation. Those spies in this ungodly procedure are doing all they can to intimidate the saints. Truth declared the entire situation as, quote, shades of Missouri mobocrats, unquote, and as being contrary to LDS scripture. It asked, quote, is the church reenacting the outrages of the Holy Crusaders, unquote. In June 1939, a discussion ensued to consider whether or not to consider the meetings. This is among the fundamentalists. Brother Joseph Musser asked the attendants at these classes if they would rather stop the meetings. Vigorous speeches were made and contending for their just rights to meet this way and for their belief in the truth, let come what may. Musser announced the consensus. This is the beginning of the end, and the meetings will go on. The featured editorial in Truth's next issue, July 1939, was a stinging assault on the church's surveillance and excommunication procedures. It began, the dread disease, hysteria excommunicatus, has again broken out in some of the wards and stakes of Zion. Symptoms include mild revulsion to independent thought. Affected officials of the church have hallucinations of members of the flock thinking and even praying for light and knowledge without special permission. Forward-thinking saints must read no books or pursue no inquiry pertaining to gospel themes not directly recommended by the leaders. Hatred for all that is good and sound develops as the disease advances into its final stages, in which the patient will tolerate in his flock no thought nor intimation on religious dogma not in conformity with its own. The following month, Truth identified J. Reuben Clark as the general authority responsible for, quote, clearing the community of polygamous teachings and living, end quote. Since the church's surveillance was hardly subtle, it is not surprising that occasional dialogue occurred between the watchers and the watched. Bishop Curtis reported the comments of fundamentalist orator Francis Darter, whom he presumed mistakenly to be the leader of the fundamentalists. Darter had complained that, quote, a standard furniture truck and a Mr. Lund were following him and that people were checking on him, and he was suspicious of a holdup and was going to report it to the police department, end quote. Joseph L. Jessup told another interaction with Curtis one evening. Jessup was approaching the Cleveland home to attend a meeting when he saw Francis M. Darter engaged in conversation with Bishop Curtis. Darter introduced the bishop to Jessup, who described the exchange. After a few minutes, my brother-in-law, Brother Axel Forrest, joined us. Brother Darter left us and went into the house. Bishop Curtis claimed to know what we were discussing in there through somebody who reports to them, a woman in particular. I said to them, quote, if you would be a real witness of what is going on in there, come in and don't just sit out there, unquote, to which he replied, I wouldn't step a foot on that property. I wouldn't follow you or anyone in there an inch. I then said to him, I'm not asking you to follow us, nor even believe a thing that is said. I'm just asking you, for the sake of decent principle, to know firsthand and be a real witness of this affair you are so concerned about. Come in. I have been one of the instructors of this class, and I'm giving you this invitation. Then he said, no one has a right to, no member of the church has a right to go in there. Only those who have been excommunicated have a right. Of course, the Constitution grants the right, but the church does not. Mr. Curtis repeatedly said that, quote, Muster hasn't told things straight in the Truth magazine, unquote, and, quote, you bet he'd better not say that I've ever been a window peeper, nor any of you better not say it either. We have a libel suit being prepared now, and if he said I've been there, he'll face a big libel suit. We're just waiting for such a statement, unquote. Jessup said the bishop hurried away, and then he and Brother Forrest attended the class and reported some of these statements to the class. Truth magazine compared the observation activities with anti-Mormon tactics of the 1800. If there is one being the early church members of the church were trained to entertain a supreme contempt for, it was a spotter. His nosy proclivities, not only volunteering to act as a witness, but also posing as a prosecutor in such cases. Despite fundamentalist objections, surveillance continued unabated. Notations in Bishop Curtis's papers indicate that Joseph L. Jessup's home was watched, especially during the fall and winter of 1939 and 40. And I could go into some more information about this situation, but it's not as relevant as some of the other information. When Bishop Curtis informed bishoprics and other LDS wards about suspected fundamentalists within ward boundaries, not all were anxious to excommunicate those who might be sympathizers or believers in continued plural marriage. A year after the investigations began, Bishop Curtis complained to President Clark that, quote, it seems that we are still having considerable trouble with bishops and stake presidents in getting them to handle these people. Anything you could do to assist us would be most sincerely appreciated. Another problem rose from the use of license plate numbers to identify polygamy sympathizers. Joseph A. Wortham of the presiding bishopric's office wrote to Bishop Curtis telling him of members of the church who had come into his office, shocked to find their name connected with the plural marriage meetings. Worthen complained, quote, it causes some embarrassment in this office when a mistake is made, unquote. He recommended a policy to check on the license of all cars twice. Challenges arose for Curtis when a new police chief, a Mr. Vetterly, replaced O.B. Record. Early in 1941, Bishop Curtis interviewed Police Chief Vetterly, who had informed him that, quote, he did not know the former police chief had been conducting an investigation, unquote. Vetterly indicated that, quote, the two men who had been making this investigation had been assigned to other work, unquote. Bishop Curtis was careful to explain to Vetterly that the police investigators had collected some very valuable information. Even though Vetterly responded that, quote, he wanted to cooperate in every way possible, unquote, Curtis still suggested to President Clark that, possibly a word to Chief Vetterly from a member of the First Presidency would help materially in having this investigation continued, as it would be a shame for this investigation to be dropped at this time when so much valuable information has already been secured, unquote. For some unknown reason, however, Vetterly did not participate as Curtis hoped. In August 1941, Curtis wrote President Clark, quote, since the changing of the chief of police, we have had no cooperation whatsoever from them. Chief Vetterly promised full cooperation. However, he has given us none whatsoever. Bishop Curtis was released as bishop of the Hawthorne Ward, and the fundamentalist immediately noticed the cessation of his activities. The Truth editorialized, it is a noteworthy fact that the, quote, Peeping Tom, quote, operations carried on for the past several months in which nosy busybodies, agents of the church, were nightly protruding their insolence into the affairs of certain of the saints have stopped. This is a step in the right direction. Let there be no peeping, no spying, no sneaking about people's windows after dark, unquote. Assuming the surveillance mission would be part of the new bishop's duties, Curtis turned over the entire and polygamy investigation file to his replacement and then notified President Clark. Upon learning this, Clark immediately arranged a meeting with Curtis. Although Curtis was no longer bishop, he was instructed by the First Presidency to continue the investigation of these special people. Although Curtis was no longer bishop, J. Reuben Clark soon furnished him with a list of new polygamists marked confidential, which he obtained from Police Inspector O.B. Record. Clark requested that Curtis send him a complete summary of those who have already been dealt with and those who have not. Curtis provided the list, naming a total of 170 persons. Of these, 32 had been investigated and cleared, 58 had been excommunicated or disfellowshipped, and several others were still under investigation. It named 24 new individuals that had not been previously reported to the presiding bishopric. The moment Curtis renewed his efforts, fundamentalists knew it. First, Truth Magazine lashed out, "To our profound surprise and regret, the official snoopers have again appeared on the scene. They were observed taking the license plate, the license number of cars, and preparing to blacklist honest people. Why these spying, snooping miscreants should continue their offensive nosing is an unsolved mystery. One would think that common decency would appeal to their reason, but nothing, it would seem, is too low for them to stoop to. We are told they are on the payroll of the church. We hope this is not true. Yet the funds of the church have been pledged for this purpose. President Taylor called this class of men skunks, and now the tithes of the saints may be used in keeping up the stinking herd. Gentlemen would not follow such an unsavory profession. If our critics want to know the nature of the deliberations in our regular Tuesday evening study class, let them come in and deport themselves as ladies and gentlemen. Many have done so, and their presence have been appreciated. We have invited these official snoopers time and again to join in the gatherings. Are they afraid, or are they just plain yellow?" I might note that not only in the Freddie Curtis papers, but among fundamentalist several sources, there were numerous invitations where they were given to come in. But in a paper that looks like it was preparation for a trial, someone's trial in the church, the front page was missing in the papers. It indicated that because one couple had been turned away from a fundamentalist meeting, it was proof that they were, quote, closed meetings. As time progressed, Curtis's letters to the First Presidency indicated increasing alarm at the growing numbers. He wrote, "It is surprising to see how many young people are joining this group. There were a total of 73 people attending in January 7, 1941. About 60% were young people under 30 years of age. This group is growing by leaps and by August 1941, Curtis's apprehension seemed almost a panic. This group is growing by leaps and bounds, and the attendance of the young people is astounding. Over 100 people attend. New members are being introduced each week, and I have reports of the doctrine of this group being taught in priesthood quorums by ward teachers and many other officers in the various wards." He pleaded with Clark for a personal meeting, writing, "We would like very much to explain to you the seriousness of this situation. We feel that the way this organization is growing, something must be done." Indeed, something was being done. President Clark had already stated that criminal prosecution should begin as soon as possible. Clark's intentions came to full fruition with the 1944 Boyden Crusade. This campaign was a massive coordination of federal, state, and local law enforcement that resulted in the arrests of 46 men and women. When appeals failed for those convicted, 15 men spent 6 months in the Utah State Penitentiary and 2 Arizona men were imprisoned at the federal penitentiary. It is noteworthy that in 1944 and subsequently, President Clark denied that he had instigated any legal actions against the fundamentalists. Others, however, were not so reticent about admitting church involvement. In October 1944, Markey Peterson of the Council of the Twelve sent an article to the San Francisco News for publication, quote, desiring that now that convictions were obtained to make it known to the world that it was the church that was doing the prosecuting. He wanted it stated that the members of this group were not Mormon. After 1944, the next sequential piece of correspondence in the Freddie Curtis papers is dated March 1953, just 4 months prior to the 53 short grades in Arizona. Markey Peterson wrote Freddie Curtis asking for a list of all the names and addresses that he might have on the matter. And a few more letters passed between them, and that was the end of the papers that are housed at the Utah Attorney General's files. Curtis once wrote a postscript to President Clark, quote, I have enjoyed my work more than I can tell, unquote. This expression seems to convey Curtis's general attitude for his special assignment. However, no clues are found in his papers that indicate when or who gave his records to the state. Perhaps they were given by Freddie Curtis himself or by one of his superiors, possibly President J. Reuben Clark or Apostle Markey Peterson. The more important question is, why were they there? The apparent answer is that the evidence gathered by Freddie Curtis and his assistants was used for the prosecution of fundamentalist Mormons for at least the 1944 Utah polygamy raids and possibly for other lesser-known prosecution. Overall, the Freddie Curtis papers indicate the LDS Church's intent to send a strong message to its members, as well as to the nation, that it had completed its transformation into a monogamous religion and that Mormon polygamy existed only in its history. Ironically, the campaign served in the long run to strengthen rather than to destroy the conviction of fundamentalist community regarding polygamy. In the 1930s, there were only a few hundred fundamentalist Mormons. Today, there are an estimated 30,000 to 40,000. J. Reuben Clark is credited with recognizing, quote, that his administrative suppression of fundamentalist Mormons, which began with his 1933 official statement, but had actually transformed a ragtag collection of polygamist sympathizers who value their church affiliation into a cohesive movement of true schismatics whom he considered an actual threat to the church. And quote, in 1945, President Clark reflected that, quote, one of the main reasons why the so-called fundamentalists had made such inroads among our young people was because we had failed to teach them the truth. This statement was one with which fundamentalists could wholeheartedly agree, but from an entirely different perspective from Clark's. It is no wonder President Clark encouraged Latter-day Saints to report to the civil authorities what they knew about current polygamists, monitored the progress of criminal court cases involving polygamists, and during the last years of his life, took particular care to ensure that local news blackouts of any stories that might give favorable publicity to fundamentalist Mormons. Thank you.
Mike, do you want to work from there or come up here?
This paper deals with the surveillance of homes and of individuals by both church and state in Utah. Ms. Watson quoted those who invoked the U.S. Constitution's Bill of Rights about the matter. But freedom of speech and freedom of assembly were not the relevant issues because they pertained to civil guarantees of public speech and public assembly, not to a private organization's limits on speech and meetings, whether public or private. The First Amendment's provision for freedom of religion was not the governing principle either, because it limits the government's ability to intrude on religion. The Constitution does not protect either government or its citizens from the power of religion and churches. The larger issue is the conflict between two different rights. First, the right of an authority structure to protect its domain, and second, the right of individuals to meet privately and speak privately about their dissent from the power structure. In both religious history and civil history, the former has usually taken precedence over the latter. Individuals usually agree with that right until they find themselves in conflict with certain aspects of the power structure. In the civil sphere, governments have always asserted their right to investigate treasonous activities and to punish traitors as defined by the government. Since treason is often difficult to prove in societies governed by law and jurisprudence, governments have also created categories of disloyalty or subversion or conspiracy, which can be more easily punished and more easily proved. Private organizations, whether churches or businesses, have followed that pattern and have inflicted whatever punishments the civil authority has allowed them to. From ancient times to the present, however, various individuals have disagreed with authority structures about what words and actions constitute disloyalty or subversion. Whether Joan of Arc or Martin Luther or Anne Hutchinson or Martin Luther King Jr., these dissenters regarded themselves, at least initially, as basically loyal to the authority structures they criticized. But the powers that be always resisted because they recognized a fundamental truth. Dissent is always destabilizing. From the distance of years or because of personal philosophy, we may regard such destabilization as a good thing because it leads to changes that we admire. But this process has always been difficult and painful for everyone involved. And the related question is something that no one knows the answer to at the beginning of dissent. Will the power structure unravel, or its domain be injured, if this dissent goes unopposed? That question is the basis for repression by every power structure, whether civil or religious. That is why democratic governments become undemocratic to their dissenting citizens, and why religions violate ethical principles when dealing with dissenting members, as well described here in this paper. And so we now have to confront the realities of Ms. Watson's case study of this pattern. It is not a pleasant story. From the 1930s to the 1950s, the LDS hierarchy engaged in threats, scare tactics, surveillance, and punishment of Mormons it regarded as subversive to the stability of the church with regard to continuing polygamy. The local official who led this effort did so with enjoyment rather than as an unpleasant necessity. Hannah Arendt once wrote about the banality of evil, but there is also a banality of repression. Whether from self-righteousness or from unquestioning obedience to official instructions, ordinary people routinely do things that are ethically destructive. However, there are those who are supportive of every act of repression in defense of an idea or power structure which they support. Therefore, I am sure that it is not unity, that there is not unity in this audience about those who are the heroes and those who are the villains in this experience of the LDS Church versus Mormon fundamentalists. However, the patterns of history indicate that repression feeds on itself, and when successful, extends into other areas. Thus, rigorous defense against dissent often results in the very thing that the power structure seeks to do to avoid, corruption of the organization. I leave it to you to decide if this pattern applies here. Thank you.
And we now have about 15 minutes time for questions from the floor of either of our presenters here. I'm going to take advantage of having the mic right this second and ask Mike my own question listening to this. If my research is correct and memory accurate, Mike, Heber J. Grant was a polygamist. Long before he was president of the church in 1918, is that correct? Have your studies, research, uncovered any personal experience in his life that made it apparently important to him in the early 1930s to issue what some have called, I think, the Third Manifesto, the second being by Joseph F. Smith in 1904. Is there something that happened around that time to have caused him and in your own research to suddenly launch this kind of activity?
Let's see. There we go. It wasn't really a sudden thing. It was a slow creeping kind of cancer of repression that developed in the LDS Church against those who continued to practice polygamy. And it began with public relations, and this really began much earlier. It had begun with Lorenzo Snow, and Lorenzo Snow had given instructions for certain individuals who had entered into plural marriage to be disciplined. The irony was that at the same time there were marriages that were occurring by permission of the first presidency, often performed by apostles. So there was this ambiguous experience of Mormonism which was affecting Heber J. Grant in a very personal way. And if we talk about personal reasons for his adamant approach to this issue, it's his own confusion as an apostle at this time and how he finally resolved that. His confusion was deeply painful for him because he wanted an heir to carry his name. And because of a variety of tragedies in his life, all of the sons that his plural wives bore to him and that his legal wife bore to him died. And so he was left with daughters who he loved, but he did not want his name to die with him. And so during this period when there were the public statements by first of all Wolfert Woodruff and then Lorenzo Snow and then Joseph F. Smith that no, there was no active authorized polygamy, he was hearing from apostles of fellow members of his quorum that in fact they had received authorization to perform plural marriage. And he was, in fact, instructed by John Henry Smith in Mexico in 1897 to perform two plural marriages, which he did himself. And yet he's torn with this issue of, here I am being commanded to perform these plural marriages, which he did, but there's this statement that he's even, and these statements are not just for public consumption. The president of the church was telling the apostles in their formal meetings that no plural marriages could be allowed, and yet he had performed them himself. Heber J. Grant had performed them, and he was hearing the president telling him in the temple meeting with the whole quorum present, these plural marriages cannot be performed anywhere in the world, and this was a huge problem for him. He could not sort it out, but eventually he decided that this was for public, not public consumption, but it was for the official records of the church because the minutes were being taken. And so he decided that he was going to marry a plural wife. And he proposed to one woman after another, only to find out she'd already become the plural wife of somebody else. And this was extraordinarily aggravating and painful for him. And finally he proposed to a woman and she accepted. And he was on a mission in Japan, and he had proposed to her during one of his visits to General Conference to speak at General Conference, and he went back to Japan. But in his mind, they were engaged to be married at his next visit to General Conference. Well, he got word in Japan that between the time she had accepted him and his next visit to General Conference, that Cowley, one of his fellow apostles, Matthias F. Cowley, had performed a marriage uniting her with an apostle. He might have felt better about that if it had been an apostle, but it was a stake president and a relative of his as well. And he felt triply betrayed. He felt betrayed by the woman, he felt betrayed by Cowley, and he felt betrayed by his distant cousin. So when it came about, and he was again on a mission when this occurred, he was in England as a missionary, when it occurred that the church acted against that Joseph F. Smith allowed the Quorum of the Twelve to act against Matthias F. Cowley, whom he felt had betrayed him, and John W. Taylor in releasing them from the Quorum of the Twelve, in Heber J. Grant's mind, they had betrayed the church as well as him. And despite all of the inconsistencies, because there were all these inconsistencies and he was always uncomfortable with it, the way he resolved it was that in some way the presidents of the churches' formal statements to the Quorum of the Twelve in their temple meetings and publicly were the real statements. And everything that had happened privately was false, was wrong. By implication, even his action in performing a plural marriage by instruction of a senior apostle was wrong. And so there was this huge reservoir of resentment, personal resentment at not ever being able to have the plural wife who would provide him with the son. This plural wife provided his cousin, or distant cousins, with sons. And, you know, this was one further personal aggravation and painful one for him. So by the time the fundamentalist movement began to grow in numbers and to become more public in terms of publications by some of his even relatives, one of them was Heber Bennion, who had married a sister-in-law. The way they were related is they had both married sisters. So they were kind of like shirt-tail brothers-in-law. And the publication by Heber Bennion and others in favor of continued polygamy continued to aggravate him. And the fact that it was a rebellion that he recognized as a rebellion, and it seemed to be growing worse. So it was a cumulative thing. It didn't suddenly happen. And it had a lot of it was based in this personal frustration that he had experienced in his own life. And so when he finally took action, he was hell on wheels against the fundamentalists.
Thank you. Questions for either of these folks? Anne? You may certainly. Saves me from having to try to summarize.
Comment and question. Comment, I think as late as the 70s, they were taking license plates on meetings that were being held in homes. I have a personal experience of that. In fact, I've got to relate a humorous thing here. We had a meeting, it was just a study group, there's nothing wrong with it, and we were studying church history, and we had several cars out in front of my house on Highland Drive, and we found out later from a printer who lived two doors down and had a high councilman visit him on a printing job that Sunday night, ironically. He was called in because his license plate number was taken because he was parked close to my house amongst all the other people that were there, and he was really upset. He did not know that the church had stooped to such Gestapo tactics. But anyway, my comment being, apparently as late as the 70s, this has been going on. Do you know of any other methods and times, examples, where this surveillance has gone on against people that they have suspect of or they are trying to investigate? One other example is I know of about four or five different people who were later cut off the church whose personal journals just came up missing. So, could you just comment on that?
Well, the success of the surveillance techniques of the LDS Church against fundamentalists in the 1930s, and as you indicated, it continued long beyond that, became the pattern for LDS surveillance of everyone else that they were suspicious of for one reason or another. By the 1970s, that included those who were suspected of being gays and lesbians. And so these very same techniques were used for those, and they would stake out the gay bars in Salt Lake City and take down license plates numbers, and then they would run them through the license plate registrations at Brigham Young University to find out if there were any BYU students who were parked in front of in the neighborhood of gay bars in Salt Lake. And then they would expel and excommunicate these students simply on that basis. Again, it was very similar. The tactics were similar. Suspicion was in itself enough to take action. I have anecdotal evidence. This I know from even the LDS Church eventually acknowledged that they were doing this. So it's not anecdotal. It wasn't stories being reported to me. But as another group of targeted people were people who were church employees who were regarded, no matter what it was that they were suspected of doing, whether it was that they would have coffee in the Hotel Utah or take a drink at a bar or whatever, the same tactics of surveillance were used against them. Now, of course, taking a drink of coffee in the Hotel Utah, pretending it was something else, as a tradition going back to J. Golden Kimball. But for going to a bar, and in the 1950s to 60s, it was more difficult to get alcohol. You couldn't buy it as easily. And so it was easier to take down license plates numbers and photograph individuals going in and out of liquor stores, in and out of bars. And so this was applied as well to church employees. And the technical ability from the 1970s forward of LDS church security has increased remarkably, because they have been directed by former FBI agents from the 1970s to the present. And so that the directors of church security, LDS church security, have been former FBI directors, or not directors, but agents. And one of them, named Bretzing, was a former field officer, director for Los Angeles. But also many of their employees are former policemen, former FBI agents. And then they have drawn on technical. So they're not only trained in their professional background of doing vehicle surveillance, foot surveillance, but also they have technical capabilities of using distant microphones that can pick up conversations in buildings. They don't have to enter your house to hear your conversation. The technical ability has existed since the 1970s for high-powered technical devices, often located in a van that's painted like a cleaning van, or a insect disposal van, or an ice cream truck, to park within a few feet, about 20 feet of a house, and to be able to hear every conversation in the house. They don't have to tap phone lines. They don't have to enter the building to put in bugs. They can listen to everything simply from the convenience of a van that they happen to be in. And long-distance photography has increased in sophistication. And these have been applied to a variety of individuals that they suspect of behavior that they don't like, when whether that behavior is gay and lesbian, whether it is a member of the staff of the central headquarters is doing something that they don't like, whether it's people attending Sunstone. If you don't think that they have taken down license plates numbers of people going into the Sunstone office, or have made efforts to identify everyone who's attended Sunstone conferences over the last numerous years, you underestimate the extent of their paranoia. They are very paranoid about a wide variety of people, but the techniques that have been used against various groups for decades were used only against fundamentalists.
Thank you. We have time for one more. Yes.
Why Hawthorne Ward? Was that a hotbed for?
Question is, why Hawthorne Ward for Marianne?
What was the correlation between the local church, the bishop there, and the police? I mean, O.B. Record was, I believe, a member of the Granite Stake at that time.
I have no idea.
And
on him.
There was a police officer, a sergeant, like, right up the street from Curtis.
He's asking what the connection was between
police
and the church.
In those papers of that, any kind of that connection, but it was a small town back in those days. Salt Lake City just wasn't that big. This just happened to be an area where there were several homes of like-minded people. They had moved there in the 1920s to get employment from Nathaniel Baldwin in his factory, the majority, and that's why they were basically centered in that area.
Well, I'm sorry, but my watch says our time is up. We thank our presenters very much, and thank you for attending.
Well, glad to. A lot of work you put into that. Now, did you stumble onto this, or did